OTB.
Bemused, I think, is probably how he feels in his head. Bemused how they could go from where they were last season, 99 points, 67 games unbeaten at home, to a situation where they could be on the edge today of losing six games in a row at home.
OTB live commentary. Never miss the action right here on OTB Sports Radio. Keep up to date with the latest scores on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Sports app. Live score updates straight to your phone. The OTB Podcast Network.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Okay, you're very welcome along. So we're reviewing the Sunday Papers. No surprises as to what's on all the front pages, the fallout from last night at the Aviva Stadium. I'll start with the Sunday Times here. Hold it up for you. We're streaming as well on our social channels. If you're just listening on the radio, then you're fine, but we're streaming as well. It's a picture of, who is it? James Collins on their knees. Luxembourg won, Ireland nil. Shock Luxembourg loss leaves Ireland humiliated and Kenny without a win in first 10 games. There's also a story beneath that about the fact that South African teams are going to be part of the Champions Cup deal. So a new 10-year deal for the Heineken Champions Cup. And the European Challenge Cup has been agreed by all six unions involved, and the South African teams will be involved. Next I have the Mail. Just as bad as it looks. A picture of Callum Robinson with his hands on his head. Philip Quinn here. Stephen Kenny's future as a manager is under growing scrutiny after lowly Luxembourg inflicted a massive World Cup embarrassment last night. Then I have another picture of, who's this? Looks like Alan Brown. Can't quite tell because he's got his shirt over his head. When your looks out. And it certainly is at the moment for Stephen Kenny. Paul O'Hare here. This is the Sunday Mirror. Stephen Kenny believes he still has the FAI's full backing despite a horror show against Minnows Luxembourg. That's not even in question and I'm not concerned about that at the moment, was what Kenny said on TV last night, I'm sure you saw. The Sun then. If looks could kill, there's lots of L-U-X in place of looks, as you can imagine if you're just listening on the radio. If looks could kill, picture of Stephen Kenny. Qualifying campaign already dead is the byline there on The Sun. Great picture on the front page of the Sunday Independent. It's Stephen Kenny turning towards, you suspect, the dressing room, or turning back towards the subs bench at some point during that match, hands in his pockets, and the body language just says something good hasn't quite happened there. The headline is rock bottom. Kenny under pressure as dismal Ireland hit new low in shock defeat to Luxembourg. And then Sunday World going especially strong with their headline, looks like Kenny's gone. Ireland boss fighting for his future after a catastrophic blow. Stephen Kenny, says Roy Curtis, is fighting for his future after Ireland's World Cup bid was dealt a catastrophic blow. And on we go. That's a flavour of the back pages. Very happy to say Kieran Cunningham, chief sports writer with the Irish Daily Star, is with us. Bernard Jackman as well, former Irish international coach with the Dragons and went Grenoble as well. So let's start with Ireland nil, Luxembourg one then. The coverage is everywhere. I'll get your own opinions in a few moments, but I think people out there might be curious to know what's in the papers. For instance, Kieran, what caught my eye, and I didn't see this anywhere else. I saw lots of Stephen Kenny under pressure and his position under scrutiny, but Paul McGrath went one step further, page 68 of the Sunday World. I never like kicking a man when he's down. I was down myself many a day. But I'm sorry, he says, Stephen Kenny, it's time to go. And he goes on to say, Stephen should know if he wants Ireland to play like Barcelona, it'd be useful to have a Xavi and an Iniesta in midfield and a Messi up front. Right now, Ireland haven't got a third cousin twice removed of any of those great players. But we're trying to pass the ball around as though we had players of that class. He says as well, sorry, going with three centre-halves in a home match with Luxembourg is just not acceptable. I know Ireland played well in Belgrade last week using that 3-5-2 formation, but it's one thing to go out with that tactic against a strong Serbian outfit on their pitch. It's another thing altogether to do it against Luxembourg at home. So, you know, he's already speculating about the likes of a Neil Lennon. So that's one piece which caught my eye in the Sunday World. What did you go to, Kieran? Where did you spend most of your time this morning?
Nothing really jumps out as being radically different to anything else, because I think part of it is because it's a late Saturday kickoff. And I think most writers there, you know, went with, you know, would have gone with the mindset that the Serbia performance was quite promising, that this would be a win, it might be that convincing, you know, but that, you know, there was going to be no question over Stephen Kenny's future after. So in those kind of circumstances, I think the reaction in the next couple of days will be more interesting, and that's where you might have more people echoing the kind of stuff that Paul McGrath had there. You know, Dan has a piece of the Sunday Independent, and Dan McDonnell, and you know, like Dan would be hugely supportive, like a lot of the media are, and with a lot of justification for what Stephen Kenny is trying to do. But he makes the point, you know, this could be his Cyprus, this could be his Macedonia. You know, a big result in a difficult year that ends up putting huge pressure on him. You know, Paul McGrath, as I say, is interesting, because Paul McGrath made his debut for Ireland when he was nearly 25. The last 8 debutants for Ireland under Stephen Kenny, Neil O'Riordan tweeted this earlier, so I got it from Neil, have had an average age of 20. And that's part of the major problem with what Stephen Kenny is trying to do. Effectively, this is a developmental squad. Too many guys have been overpromoted when they're not ready, because there isn't any choice. You know, you could say it's a missing generation of players between 24 and 30. But I think they're following on. There's been 2 or 3 missing generations because of mismanagement at a lot of levels. It wasn't just John Delaney. There's a lot of other people who've been involved in Irish football that would need to look in the mirror. But generally, if you looked at the best Irish players over the years, they made their debuts in their mid-20s. Now, fillers are coming in, being thrown into the deep end, who are more suited to an Ireland B team, which we used to have years ago. And they've been forced to sink or swim. But you had 4 goalkeepers. Of the 4 first-choice goalkeepers now, 3 of them are at their bench at their club. The other is Gavin Bazunu, who played last night. He was 19 this year, a couple of months ago. He's playing for Rochdale on loan, who are bottom of League One, who conceded 67 goals this year. That's where we are. You know, that's Ireland. This didn't come. I can't understand how there's any shock about this. This was coming. If you think of the away game against Gibraltar, the save Darren Randall made in the first, I think it was the first half, he made a fantastic save. They could have lost to Gibraltar. They beat them 1-0 both times. If you go through the results since the Aviva has opened, since the redevelopment of Lansdowne Road, Aviva opened, there was a freakish win over Germany. Other than that, Ireland have only beaten really low-tier teams there. Like, the Irish slippage has been there for a long, long time. And Stephen Kenny has inherited a very bad situation. I don't think he's going to turn around, because I think this is a very long-term business we're in now. I don't think it's going to turn around 2 or 3 campaigns. So just a final point on that. If you look at now, we have to write off this World Cup campaign. So you're looking at the Euros of 2024. The Euros 2024, by the time that comes around, Seamus Coleman, Matt Doherty, Enda Stevens, Kieran Clark, Darren Randall, James McLean, James McCarthy, Robbie Brady, Jeff Hendrick, Conor Hourihan, Shane Duffy and Shane Long will be aged between 32 and 37, and John Egan will be nearly 31. So you see the amount of transition that's needed. Like, you know, even if you get those guys through that campaign, like, it's okay saying you've got 3 or 4 or 5 players through for this campaign. You're going to need that in the next campaign at least, and they're going to need a campaign or two to get to the level they need to be at. So this Irish football is in a mess. There's no cut and paste model from Netherlands is going to help, because Netherlands is nowhere like the Irish culture. They don't have a GAA. They don't have a strong rugby. They don't have the little fiefdoms and the little chieftains all around the country who are fighting with each other all the time. But Irish football is in a bad place, and maybe last night will make people realise that.
Yeah. So Neil O'Riordan in The Sun says that this was a taxing watch, and given the 2 countries involved, makes it somewhat ironic, which was a good line. There are no circumstances, he says, under which defeat to Luxembourg is acceptable for an Ireland side. But a 10-match winless streak with Stephen Kenny in charge for 9 of them is the team's worst run in 49 years, he points out. Michael Foley in the Sunday Times, the byline is fortune has not been on Kenny's side, but this was a new low that needs explaining. He concludes by saying, it seems unfair that Kenny's job should come under threat so quickly given the awful poverty of talent and the run of bad luck with injuries and absentees, but last night was inexcusable. It provokes profound questions that need answering. Dan McDonald's piece you referenced, Ciarán, the headline in that is fallout from defeat will be brutal for Boss. And he does say Luxembourg's now the stick to beat Stephen Kenny with, a result that leaves a stench which the Ireland boss will find hard to shake off. And he says, you know, things like Knight was favoured to another Derby graduate in midfield, Jeff Hendrick. He says their selection by Kenny was flagged as evidence of trust in youth, but it may be cast in a different light now, a shunning of experience. And then Eamon Sweeney, next to Dan McDonald's piece, starts off by saying this was the night the dream died. Stephen Kenny may continue to the end of qualifying, but he'll be a lame duck. All the hopes invested in him cannot survive the evidence furnished by one of the worst results in Irish international history. Bernard Jackman. Andy Farrell thought he had problems.
Yeah, exactly. I'm the same. I didn't see any real articles that stood out. I suppose Paul Kimmich spoke around, you know, the good old days when all our players were household names. And when I compared, you know, some of the examples he gave to the team sheet for last night, it hits home, you know, how difficult it is for Kenny. And I think we have to understand that the problems in an organization don't necessarily aren't manifested straight away in terms of the results. But, you know, looking at some of the governance issues, I heard Brian Kerr last night talk around our kind of player development structures and processes. That's all catching up on us now. And Stephen Kenny, unfortunately, is in the front line. Now, obviously, we could talk about his philosophy of play and is that overly ambitious for the current talent pool he has. But I think that, you know, you look at some of the things that have happened off the field and his role in that is debatable. But I don't think he has the talent pool. And you could say, oh, maybe it's comparable with Luxembourg. But maybe Luxembourg have less issues off the field and they're a more settled team and, you know, maybe there's more cohesion, etc. And I also think he's badly lacking leadership and character in his playing squad as well, which is a tough situation. So he's in the firing line. Interestingly, it's not a soccer article, but David Walsh in the Sunday Times back page, you know, does a little bit of a look at the coaches in the Six Nations and how Gregor Townsend, you know, there's massive pressure to sack him post World Cup when they lost to Japan and didn't qualify, and now he's one of the winning most coaches. 17 victories in 33 tests for Scotland is a very successful record. You know, the winners of the Six Nations, Wayne Pivac, he had a disastrous 2020, only won two games, you know, and obviously that was the team that got to a World Cup semi-final, but they stayed with him and they turned it around. So I think that there's a lot to be learned from sticking with him, but and understanding the things that are going around in the background. Now, the only thing I would say is, and I'm not an expert in this, you guys would know a lot more than me, is his philosophy of play ever going to be achievable with that talent pool? And, you know, will he have to give it a little bit? For example, in rugby, both Gregor Townsend and Wayne Pivac gave up a little bit of their philosophy that they had with Scarlets and Glasgow to try and great success at the international level. So that's the only thing for me that I'm not sure about, but I think it's going to be pivotal in terms of whether he survives.
I think, Kieran, I'd put it to you, it's a really good question, Bernard. In fact, it's the key question. And it was always the question down the years, you know, under Trapp, under O'Neill, under Keane, you know, are the players good enough? No, they're not, says the manager. Yes, they are, says lots of other people, and they're just not being encouraged to play. They're being encouraged to play now, Kieran, and on the evidence of last night, for instance, when they have to take a game to an opposition like Serbia. It's about shape and discipline and being organised and trying to, you know, in the odd pocket or breakaway, try and put some passes together. It's a different thing entirely when you're the dominant team at home trying to take the game to an opposition. And last night, you would just have to say too many of those players couldn't do it. And, you know, we had Kevin Kilbane and David Myler on and they were saying like some of the mistakes you see, the basics, they happen sometimes. But I mean, at a certain point, what you do is what you are.
Yeah. No, that's a fair point. I listened to what Kevin and David said, and they made a lot of interesting points. I think maybe the argument about the style of play was more valid a few years ago, because these days most of the players play that way at their clubs. Like this is the way football has gone. There are very few clubs that don't play this way.
That's true.
Like, look, watch Luxembourg last night. When they got their goal kicks, they're passing the ball around. The defenders are passing between themselves and the goalkeeper with inside the box. Like, that is the way football is played now. And if you go, oh, Ireland should go more direct. Ireland don't have David McGoldrick, a big, powerful man who can run channels up front anymore. They don't have John Walters anymore. It's a long, long time since they've Niall Quinn. Yeah. Like the strikers that have come through are small and nippy and skillful. You know, you could say there was a striking lack of control in midfield. But you have Josh Cullen and Jason Knight. Like they're two rookies, they're two kids. You keep going back to this. They're kids learning their trade at club level, and they've been thrown in. You know, at international level now. And the other thing we often forget is what other countries are doing. It's like Bernard would know this because Bernard has a lot of experience in coaching. The most radical change in sport over the last 20, 25 years is the coaching revolution. Like the amount of, you know, there's fantastic coaches now in Ireland in boxing, cycling, gymnastics, athletics. You know, they're at a level they never were before. And that's not to mention the rugby coaches, the coaches in GAA, etc. So you see now, how have Luxembourg improved so much? It's down to coaching. Mm. You know, how have Luxembourg players in the playing in the Champions League when Ireland don't? How have America 10 players playing in the Champions League this season and are now looked on as possible contenders for a World Cup down the line? Not straight away, but with the talent coming through, they're getting to that level. It's down to coaching. So just because Ireland are making steps forward, or you know, Stephen Kenny comes in with a new way of playing and a new coaching philosophy, everybody else is going to be effort into coaching as well. Ireland are playing catch up because of neglect over decades. Mm. And it's going to be very, very hard to make that up, particularly because the FAI are up to their eyes in debt. We're probably going into a COVID recession. There's not going to be much state funds for sport. And Irish sport across the board needs more funding. It's in a very difficult situation at the moment. So I would be very worried about the future of Irish soccer.
Yeah. Paul Kimmage picks up on the theme, the great unknowns now carry our hopes. And I think he flicked over on Wednesday and found himself scratching his head a bit, wondering who some of these players were, because he just hadn't seen very much of them. And he was harking back to the last trip to Serbia. He was there, Belgrade, November 1998. And even just reading this line, you kind of think, my God, did we ever appreciate how good we were for a while? After a 2-0 win against Croatia, I mean, that's not coming around the corner anytime soon. And a 5-0 win against Malta. The first trip on the road for the boys in green was a visit to the Red Star Stadium, a cauldron. Here's the team that started that night in 1998. Shea Given in goal. Gary Breen, Steve Staunton, Dennis Irwin, Kenny Cunningham, Damien Duff, Jason McAteer, Mark Kinsella, Alan McLaughlin, who we wish all the best to, by the way, Alan McLaughlin, Robbie Keane, Niall Quinn. Like, there's just no comparison, you know, and I think...
Chris, but I would bring up the point as well. There's 2 points on that, Joe. One, bar Shea Given and Robbie Keane, most of those guys...
Oh, you're gone. Sorry, we've lost Kieran Cunningham there. We'll get you back. Oh, you're back now, sorry. We last heard you where you said bar Robbie Keane and Damien Duff.
Bar two or three of those. They all made their debuts in the mid to late 20s. So they were seasoned club players by the time they made the step up. Mm. And the other thing is, even since 1998, the globalization of the game has been has moved at a rate of knots. Like it's far more difficult for young Irish players to play even at championship level now than it was.
Well, isn't that the point, really? You know, like the likes of, I was making the point even before news, the likes of Niall Quinn, who went over a little bit late and kind of had to fight his way in, and Arsenal persevered with him for a time. That just wouldn't happen these days because the clubs have the best players from around the world arriving. Maybe Brexit changes that to an extent, I don't know. But, you know, Irish players going over to England now are not competing with just the best of Scotland, England and Wales. It's the best of the world quite often. And then at home, as you said, it's a mess. I mean, Miguel Delaney had that piece 6 years ago, which has been doing the rounds again, and it's quite staggering to read it. So in that piece from 6 years ago, basically one very informed source described the Irish system, you know, around the country, all the different leagues, all the different fiefdoms, as you just said, Kieran, as the most dysfunctional, or as dysfunctional as anything he had seen in Europe. I mean, you think about that for a second, as dysfunctional as anything in Europe. There was an FAI employee quoted in that piece from 6 years ago saying, you know, really, we do need a pyramid structure. We do need, if you're, you know, six and you're the best player right through to senior level, we do need a proper pyramid structure, not just the ceilings and gaps that there are in the system. And the quote was, why bother? It's a political nightmare. And at that time, the SFAI and the DDSL were at war. The SFAI, that's the schoolboy section of the FAI, rejected 44 of 51 guidelines in a 2009 review. There were still certain leagues around the country, not all of them, which kind of emphasises the point, but certain leagues around the country where the under-12s are still on full-size pitches, full-size goals, going against best practice. And in other pockets, they were playing on smaller pitches and smaller goals. And that's the legacy, really, Bernard, isn't it? I mean, here we are 6 years and beyond later. The players we saw on the pitch last night, in the main, a lot of them, came through that dysfunctional system. And then even in the last couple of years, to add in the problem of debt, we tried to get national leagues in place, and we have got national leagues in place at last, under 13 and under 15 and under 17. The reason it's not under 13, under 14, under 15, the reason there's a gap year is down to money. just can't afford to put on that league. So you've got a bunch of talented players who play a National League under 13 and then 14, I guess it's, well, you better go home to whatever club you played for growing up, play for them for a year, then come back to us at under 15 and play National League again. And then at the end of that season, go back to your local club. I mean, what kid wants to do that? That's no fun at all. So we have a more competitive Premier League academy system than ever. And then we have this mess at home. And so that's why it finished Luxembourg 1, Ireland 0. It's not just down to blame Stephen Kenny.
No, and in high performance sport, you know, success leaves clues, but so does failure. And I think if you go through any sport, or, and whether it's boxing or any other high performance sport, if there's not alignment all the way from the top down to the bottom, eventually it will catch up on you. And we obviously now are suffering from the dysfunctional structures and politics that were in place for 10 years. And the odd bit of success at international level papered over those cracks, but eventually you get caught out, and we're in this now. And again, you mentioned some positive changes there, but unless we have structures and systems in place that are world class, you know, like even if we have now, and they only came in 2 years ago, it'll take 5 or 6 years for that to pay off. And and I would say again, I mean, you see this national team, international team struggling. Is that going to affect, you know, the next generation? Will they jump into Gaelic football or hurling? You know, will they go into rugby because it's more attractive? So it might be even harder to get those talented kids to stay in the game because there's more choice now. So and I don't know if the changes have been made. You know, you mentioned some changes there, but and I don't think it's all about money. I know money is a factor, but like
It was the reason given, for instance, that there's no National League at every age grade, that it's every second age grade. So, that's an instance where, you know, the mess that the FAI has got itself into has had a real, you know, effect on bringing through good players.
And that's a disaster. I mean, that's a disaster for the sport. And they need to try and find a way of bridging that gap. You know, if they've actually identified where the gaps are in their system, and they're not filling those because of financial pressures, it's a, like,
but we're 50 million in debt. Like, I don't think we have fully, because the government swept in and bailed us out, I'm not sure we have fully grasped what's happened in Irish football over the last decade. Like, the scandal that is, we're 50 million in debt. Like, we're it's horrific.
Yeah, absolutely. But my point is, my point would be, we need to try and find, development actually isn't as expensive as maybe you think. I mean, organizing a different structural competition for your underage isn't where the money is. The money is at the high end. So look, I would say they need to prioritize where they spend their budget if there is gaps in the system.
You were trying to come in there, Kieran, I think.
Yeah, Joe, because like it's not that long, like 2 or 3 years ago, or even less, like before the whole John Delaney stories broke, that people were talking about the League of Ireland being the pathway for the future, because the old pathway of going to England and making your name there and then playing for the international team, that was becoming harder and harder for young Irish players. Yeah. But because of all the debt we have now, and because like Brian Kerr highlighted this the other night, you know, you can't write off a World Cup campaign because so much depends on it in terms of revenue and sponsors, etc. You know, it can't be looked on as a developmental competition. And so the finances do matter, because League of Ireland, to get to a level where it could produce players of the future, needs a huge amount of investment. And because of all that's happened around the national team, I can't see how that is going to happen. You know, there's any chance of that happening. So, you know, it does come back to the debt. Like, that is a massive part of it. The legacy of John Delaney is a massive part of where we are now. But as I keep saying, he's not the only one. Like, it's too easy to say this is all about John Delaney. A hell of a lot of people still involved in Irish football that, you know, should be looking in the mirror too.
A last point then, Bernard, you've been in that very lonely spot morning after a terrible defeat where everybody's given out and no one's happy and you're the worst person ever and all that kind of stuff. And I suspect, you know, Stephen Kenny is in the horrors this morning. Shane McGrath, for instance, in the Mail, page 76, Kenny Dream has no future after this nightmare defeat. He says, whether there will be a tomorrow for the national team as dreamed up by Stephen Kenny is now the question. How the manager recovers from this truly shocking performance and result is difficult to see. He goes on to write at a later point, finding a way back from this will take all of his ideas and his self-belief, but that all supposes that he will be given the time to do so, because a defeat this serious raises critical questions. The difficulty for Kenny is that this project is supposed to be about the style as much as the outcome, and this was an embarrassing failure on both fronts. And that probably captures the difficulty at the moment. For Stephen Kenny, Portugal away is the next game. It's in 6 months. I mean, he's in a, it's just a tricky, terrible spot, Bernard. What did you learn from being in this kind of a situation? What's the best way to muddle your way through?
Yeah, I think you just need to be in a constant, communicate up and communicate down. So, you know, his contacts in the FAI, the people who are in charge of his future, he needs to be close to them, understand how, what pressure they're under, understand how they feel about his future. And obviously, I would say his coaching staff. And we know there's issues in terms of departures from that. But as a coaching team, they need to be unified. They need to make a plan. Readjust the plan maybe, but have an understanding of what's needed over the next 6 months, what work they can do with the players, even in even though there won't be direct contact with them, to try and get them back believing in themselves. Because it's not just the coach's confidence or the manager's confidence that's going to be shot. Those players are going to be shot as well. So he needs to understand, you know, are they willing to roll up their sleeves and stay in the fight? So I think there's going to be a lot. The most important thing is to communicate, you know, as I said, up and down. Understand what people are feeling, understand what he's doing well, what he's not doing well, and, you know, try and adjust it so that we go to Portugal with some kind of chance of getting some positives from it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the problem, as you said, there's no positives from last night, not a chance to implement a style of play, and obviously the result is horrendous. We know the result against, well, I presume the result against Portugal will be difficult.
Yeah.
But could there be confidence and I suppose positives to be taken from certain aspects of it?
Yeah, the word from players is they're really enjoying camp. They really rate what Kenny is trying to do with them, and they're very much still on board. So a same question to you, Kieran. What has he got left? He's got Portugal twice. He has got Serbia at home, Luxembourg away, Azerbaijan twice. I mean, for now, World Cup qualification is gone. It's probably over the next six games about signs of progress, still sticking to his ideals, hopefully better patches of football, breaking out some goals, couple of wins, and enough to say, look, this is a period of transition. And, you know, as Kevin Kilbane and David Myler both said before, the ad break there, an international manager really needs two campaigns to be judged properly.
Yeah. But a big part of the problem is... like the line I heard a few times last night was the only way is up. I wouldn't go that far because things could get a... Like Ireland could finish bottom of this group. Like Azerbaijan played Portugal last week and only lost by 1-0 to an own goal. Ireland would play Azerbaijan twice. They have to go away to Luxembourg and beat them last night. They have to play Serbia again and to play Portugal twice. So can you look at one of those results and say, that's a gimme, that's three definite points? I can't. So that all has an impact on seeding then for the Euros and other positions down the line. So at the moment, it's not just damage limitation, it's fight for your lives, because the lower down seeds go, the harder the transition is going to be in the future. So it's a very tough job for Stephen Kenny. I feel sympathy for him because he will get criticised. He's not completely blameless by any means. Of course not. The players and management, the coaches have to take it on the chin. But he's taken on job at probably the worst possible time. It's definitely the worst time in 50 years. You know, like, since Eamon Dunphy retired, Eamon played 23 times, he only won two games. So that's how bleak things were back then. But since then, even at the worst times, like Liam Toohey worked part-time as an ice cream salesman, he was manager, he was still able to beat France at home. Like, this was, to me, the worst result Ireland have ever had. So we're in a very bad position. It's going to be hard, a long, long road back.
Gents, we'll take a short break. Sorry, Bernard, do you want to come in briefly?
Just last point on this, and it's nothing to do with my bias towards rugby, but if 50 million is going to harm our opportunity to develop the next generation, is there a way we can reduce that by maybe selling our stake in the stadium or whatever? I just think that it's the job of the FAI is to promote football in Ireland. And if that debt is going to stop it long term, they need to look at ways of trying to reduce it.
Okay, we'll take a short break. Welcome back. Bernard Jackman with us, Kieran Cunningham as well. So we've talked Ireland. Let's talk Pro 14 final. Lots of coverage across the papers. Bernard, I'll get the ball rolling with Neil Francis, for instance. So... Johan van Gran and Stephen Kenny may be sharing a text or two this morning saying, look, it ain't all that bad. So this was probably, says Neil Francis, the most demoralising loss for Munster in the way that they had a heightened sense of hope. This was the best team they'd been able to field in a long time. He mentioned 29 missed tackles. He says the margin of 10 points, Leinster won 16-6, if anyone missed it last night, their fourth Pro 14 title in a row. Margin of 10 points tells you nothing. It was an unbridgeable difference between the sides. Leinster butchered four try-scoring opportunities in the first half. They were held up over the line three times as well during the first 40, and a similar number in the second half. It could easily have been a 20-point difference at half-time. The question must be asked, where are Munster going, and how much longer can their head coach stay in his job? There's a stultifying lack of creativity in the side, he says. Compliments Henshaw on how brilliant he was. And then he concludes by saying, Munster have regressed under Van Gran. If it's a dry day at Thomond next week, Toulouse have the personnel and the capacity to cause serious damage. Stephen Larkham also in the crosshairs as Munster labour. They still can't pass under pressure. A win next week against Toulouse, not out of the question. But if it happens, it will only prolong the agony. Munster should be an awful lot better than this.
Yeah, I'd agree, and I picked out Frano as well. I mean, knowing how to win is more important than recognising how to not to lose. The Leinster side were never going to lose yesterday. I have a feeling this match was probably won before kickoff, and I actually thought Munster, it was set up for them, really, given the strength of the team they had, Carberry back, given that Leinster, let's be honest, you know, took a gamble as such, or looked like a gamble by keeping Tadhg Furlong, you know, Johnny Sexton on the bench, Ryan Baird, and Munster still couldn't really land a blow. They defended, you know, they scrambled really well the first half. And you know, Dennis Walsh says it would be wrong to say that Leinster were ruthless because they should have won by 20 points. And I think, look, Johan is in the firing line now. But this is a generation of Munster players who for 10 years haven't won a trophy, right? And it's easy to say, oh, but they're competing with Leinster, and Leinster have the private schools, and Leinster have the population. In those 10 years, there's Glasgow players, Connacht players, and Scarlets players who have a trophy and a medal. All right, so it's not as if Leinster have been dominant for 10 years. They've been very strong for the last 4 years, but they had a dip as well. They had a period when Johnny left and transitioned after Joe Schmidt where they weren't as good as they are now. Mm. So, and I just think that those players have blamed Anthony Foley, they've blamed Rob Penny, they've blamed, well, not they haven't blamed Razzie Erasmus, but they didn't win under him. They didn't win a trophy under him before he left. They got beaten in the semi-finals. And now Johan is the next guy in the firing line, despite the fact that, you know, Felix Jones and Gerry Flannery weren't giving him the detail they want. Now they have Graham Rowntree, they have Stephen Larkham. You know, they went out and signed Damien Delande and RG Snyman. I know Snyman's injured, but they also got Joey Carberry, Chris Farrell. But there's a generation there who have 150 caps for Munster, who unfortunately haven't added to the history of the club. And I don't blame Johan van Gran. And I'm not here to stick up for coaches because, you know, I've been in that profession in such. But I think when you have to look at each group, and this group, unfortunately, some of the big-name players have played better for Ireland than they play for Munster. And you think back, Leinster have won the last six Leinster-Munster clashes. It's very difficult to beat the same team who have equal, are very close to equal talent six times in a row. And even in those games, like, tell me the last time Conor Murray, Peter Manny, CJ Stander, Keith Earls were outstanding in those games, over six games. So, I don't know. I think it's back to going back to where it started was, I think that the match was won before kickoff. And I think Munster at the moment don't believe, or this group of players don't believe that they can beat Leinster, which is, if you want to create a dynasty and a sense of dominance, you know, creating that in people's heads, which it's phenomenal for Leo Cullen, Stuart Lancaster and team, because then you can have a day where you don't play to your best and you win anyway. And I think yesterday, as they said, they were sloppy in the first half and they just went in at half time and said, right, let's just, you know, power up here, roll up our sleeves, let's just physically dominate them and we win anyway.
That all sounds very damning, because after the 13-10 loss at Thomond in January, there was maybe a sense Munster were closing the gap, but in real terms, based on yesterday and what you're saying, that's not happening.
Well, look, fairness, I picked out clips from that game going, if Munster fix this, they have a great chance of winning them. And it was down to just, you know, two moments where, well, a couple of goal kicks, but it's two moments where they just lost a little bit of concentration. But yesterday, it was like Leinster learned from that more than Munster, you know, and Leinster just kicked on to another level. And yeah, it is damning. And I don't mean to, like, I'm not assassinating people here or whatever, but I just think that, like, I genuinely felt, you know, Billy Holland's retiring, he's been a great servant, CJ's moving on. Munster seemed to have lost what made them special, which was this ability to get the emotional pitch right, okay? And in rugby, and we saw it Ireland, England, and we see it regularly in rugby, that emotion can make up for a lot of inadequacies tactically, talent-wise, or technically. But unfortunately for Munster, it seems like it's just they have a game plan, and if that doesn't work, well then, you know, it's over. Whereas I think for them to beat Leinster, they need to go a little bit deeper emotionally, to just beat them once, and that changes the whole dynamic of it. But at the moment, it's like their motto is stand up and fight, and I haven't seen a huge amount of that in the games against Leinster for the last, you know, six occasions.
Okay, Kieran, something totally different. Talking Sport is the headline, page 18 of the Sunday Independent. You picked this out. This is Barry Brophy. Barry is a lecturer in communications at UCD, and he's talking about sports punditry, and he has spoken to Eamon Dunphy, Dermot Gleese and Brian Kerr about what they see as the kernels of good punditry. We enjoy our punditry in this country more than we do the matches, in truth.
Yeah, and it's remarkable because the amount of sporting stories in this country that emanate from something a pundit said, and then somebody reacting to what the pundit said, and then somebody else reacting to the pundit. So it's going on and like, you know, because even last night, I noticed people saying, oh, I wish the old RT panel were on. You know, what would he say? Because it would be one of the great existential debates that could bring in anything from the rise of neoliberalism to what is Jordan Peterson really on about? Like, God knows what they would have thrown into the mix. But this is interesting because the people he picked, there were three good people to pick. Because he picked Eamon Dunphy, Dermot Gleese, and Brian Kerr. And but there's just a lot of little nuggets in it that stood out to me. Like, there's, Brian Kerr is on with Graeme Souness on Virgin. And I would say, I don't know if Graeme Souness had any clue who Brian Kerr was when he first sat in the studio with him. He might have remembered him managing for Ireland, he might not. But he mentions this, you know, Souness has often said some of the nights we'd finish, he'd say to the director, how many people are watching this? This is a really good show. He'd say, with Stato there, he might call me Stato, meaning Brian, and me and your man, it's a good show. And of course, everybody's delighted with that. But I think people behind the scenes could create that atmosphere as well. Like, you know that from TV. It's not just the people front of the house that make the show. It's really, you know, there's so many people that nobody know about that's important. But it's an interesting read because it's a bit different. There's a bit of depth to it, you know. And I think, I can't remember, I'm just trying to find it here, but somebody makes a point, it might be Dermot Gleese, about how important personality is. Mm. Like, it's not just the words of a pundit, but it's how your personality comes across. And like the late Jerry Kiernan, there were so many brilliant tributes to him. And Jerry's, have you ever met Jerry? He's such a brilliant, engaging personality. And it came across on TV. And a lot of the pundits now in different sports now are a bit identical to me. There's still some very good ones there, but there's not quite as many strong personalities. And I think it's one of the reasons Roy Keane has done so well. Even though his punditry can be a bit one note, he's a very distinctive personality and he's a bit of humour. Mm. And that's made him hugely popular.
Mm. Bernard, I suspect you read this with interest, given you're often being asked questions on TV. What jumped out to you?
Just the whole thing about storytelling. And and Dunphy, obviously, I listened to Dunphy's podcast depending on the guest, and I think it's excellent. But just the difference between, you know, being the interviewer, being the analyst, the whole exercise to enlighten or amuse or to entertain the person who switches on. And if you're doing your job well, people have a good experience of eavesdropping in on a good conversation. And then obviously Brian Kerr as well. It just, you know, there's a sense that people who are good verbal communicators don't know why they're good verbal communicators. And some people have a gift for it and are able to entertain and engage, and you know, those three, you know, it's a lovely piece. It's fascinating, and it's something that's, you know, I don't think you can go to, well, maybe I need to, but I think you can go to school or college to be an analyst. These people are all just seem to be highly engaging and good communicators.
Mm. Would you agree with Kieran's sense that these days, in comparison with the halcyon days, as people I suspect would regard them, of Dunphy and Giles and Brady and probably, you know, Hook in his heyday and Brent Pope there as well, that it's all just a bit too nice these days? Not enough arguments, not enough tough talk?
It's definitely changed. But I think you can't make it up. You know, you're either that personality, the George Hook or the Eamon Dunphy, or you're not. And there's probably less of those in society, less of those in the punditry, people who are willing to go against the grain. So, yeah, I think it has changed. Mm. It has changed. But I don't think somebody trying to play, like, I think Roy Keane doesn't, he might play up a little bit, but it's part of his personality. I think if you try and go down that route and it's not genuine, it'll become obvious pretty quickly.
Kieran, I suspect often you're sighing to yourself and thinking it ain't what it used to be when you're watching the post-match discussions.
Yeah, but they had their day. I think, you know, they had a good run at it. You know, I think change is good too, but I would always be wary of getting rid of too much knowledge because of somebody's age, you know, and that's where somebody like Dermot Gillies comes in, because he mentions the time he was on the paper review around the Irish Open 3 years ago, and he was talking about the poor scoring of the Irish players, and he mentions Rory deciding on the tee that he was going to take his driver out and overpower the golf course. Now, Jack Nicklaus came over to play the Open Championship for the first time in 1962 in Troon, and Joe Carr told me that he consulted with Joe and talked with him about how you should actually play a links. What was the difference between it and the target courses that Nicklaus was used to in the States? So he brings that in. He brings Christy O'Connor in as well. And that's Dermot naturally remembering something from his experience, you know, and stories that he didn't do his homework beforehand and think, oh, that's a good story. I'm going to tell Joe Malloy about Jack Nicklaus and Joe Carr and bring in Christy O'Connor. It's just an organic thing, because knowledge, you do accumulate knowledge over the years. And I think often older pundits have that naturally. And things that have a relevance, even though they mightn't have played 20, 30, 40 years ago. And in a way, you have to be a bit careful when you're changing up panels, you know, that you're not bringing somebody in just because they're younger, just because they've played more recently.
Mm. Yeah, it's well worth the read. And actually, you mentioned Dermot Gillies. He's a great piece, two great pieces. One on Ian Woosnam, which I really enjoyed, and he was just talking about how Woosnam held up a few promises to come over and play in Ireland after he won the major at Augusta back in 91, and there's a nice few bits of colour in there which is worth checking out. But also he's been talking to Pete Cowan, or he's got some quotes from Pete Cowan, who's taken over as Rory's coach. Michael Bannon not fired, I should add, but Pete Cowan added to the team. And there's such an insightful quote from Pete Cowan, really interesting on the balance to strike with McIlroy, I'll just mention to you. Rory, he says to Dermot Gillies, is probably the most talented hand-to-eye coordinated player you'll ever see. He's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. That's why he can win by 10 shots, because he's so far ahead of the rest. Most of the top guys are hand-eye coordinated, but Rory's just better than the rest at doing it. By definition, however, this has to be inconsistent. One week it's brilliant, the next week not so good. To achieve consistency, the necessary technique would almost take something away. Too much technical stuff would diminish his remarkable talent. End quote. As Dermot says, this is the balance Cowan will be attempting to strike. It's brilliantly put, really insightful. It's on page 16 of the Sunday Independent if you want to check it out. Bernard, something you picked out then, the Mail and Nick Harris in particular have done a lot of great pieces on the British cycling situation. I know people are a bit fed up with this, right? I know they are from Texin, the Team Sky stuff, Dave Brailsford, but this is genuinely a striking story. So it would seem that UK anti-doping, UCAD, are now under investigation by WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency. So the headline is, the dodgy drug sample, the private tip-off, the secret tests, how British drug busters allowed their Olympians avoid crucial doping probe. And this is genuinely serious. And Nick Harris, he starts by remembering the summer of 2012, a triumph for British sport, 65 medals for Team GB, their best performance in 104 years, 19 of them gold. Of those 19 goals, 12 came from a single sport, cycling. 12 medals in total, 8 goals. Team GB riders won 8 gold medals, 12 in total. 7 world records. So this was, I mean, I was there, I remember British cycling. It was shortly after they won the Tour de France as well, Bradley Wiggins had, and it was just top of the world. So basically, Mail and Sunday have discovered that in the run-up to 2012, British cycling had been allowed by UCAD to conduct their own secret internal doping probe. So what seems to have happened here is that a test was returned by one of their riders, which showed a high level of nandrolone. And basically, rather than when this happened, UCAD suddenly pursuing this case, they allowed British Cycling themselves to send samples of their riders to their own lab privately. So basically, this sample was returned by one member of a high-profile group of British riders, and then a small group were asked by British Cycling to submit private follow-up urine screenings. The Mail of Sunday knows the identities of these riders who were screened, contacted them for comment. They all declined to do so on the record. And Nick Harris writes, the tip-off to British Cycling that one of their riders had the irregular nandrolone metabolites in 2010 came from UCAD's head of legal to British Cycling. Head of British Cycling at that stage was Dave Brailsford, Steve Peters, Richard Freeman, Shane Sutton. There's a lot of detail in this, but suffice to say, it was odd, and it goes against WADA regulations that UCAD didn't investigate this when the sample came back, that they allowed British Cycling to then take samples from their own riders and try and figure out what was happening. And now WADA are investigating UCAD. So, Bernard, this caught your eye for obvious reasons. In effect, British Cycling were kind of allowed to get to the bottom of what had happened with this sample themselves. And British Cycling felt there were four reasons, either naturally occurring high level, either contamination of supplement, either a lone wolf doping rider, or else a rider doping with the assistance of somebody inside British Cycling. Now, they ruled out the naturally occurring high level and they ruled out contamination of supplements, which leaves the other two, but we don't really know what happened there. And it just seems crazy.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, from this side of the world, you know, we've read about the, you know, the Chinese, the Russians and the Kenyans and the possible cover up there. But this looks like it's very damning for UK sport, to be honest. And, you know, WADA are commonly perceived to delve into the affairs only of rogue anti-doping organizations such as Russia, which is notoriously central to the country's state-sponsored doping and cover-up. So, and look, we all, well, I certainly did, looked in from afar and listened to podcasts and read about this marginal, these marginal gains and this high-performance environment that was producing incredible success at a high level. And now, whatever, this is 2012, now 8-9 years later, we're looking at, I suppose, some evidence and a lack of clarity as well. I mean, you know, UCAD said they have no record of conversation between Arthur and the lab boss. Asked if anyone at UCAD had seen the results of British Cycling's private urine testing. There's no record of this. I mean, it just seems to be a massive cover-up. And I know people, yeah, as you say, people are probably sick of it, but I thought this was a good two-page spread with extracts from emails and a chronological account of how it all unfolded, and yet how poor the communication is, or the note keeping that can now give us, you know, more details on it, and using GDPR, using the excuse that no one from British Cycling that was there is still there as a reason to, I suppose, hold back information isn't really cutting it.
Yeah. So two things, Kieran. One, that UCAD, who are meant to oversee all of UK anti-doping, said to British Cycling, okay, there's been this test. You guys go ahead and sort it out in-house. One, that's what WADA are investigating. And then as for British Cycling, who went off and sorted them out themselves, the Mail on Sunday asked them that once they had ruled out the fact that it was, you know, naturally occurring high level of nandrolone, or that a supplement had been contaminated, leaving the other two options of lone wolf, doping alone, or else a rider doping with the insistence of somebody. So the Mail on Sunday said, well, once you'd got rid of the contamination possibility, and once you'd got rid of the naturally occurring nandrolone possibility, why didn't you follow up, or what happened there? So a spokesperson for British Cycling has said this week, none of the people relevant to your inquiry now work for British Cycling. This makes it difficult to check any of the information you have sent, particularly given the events are from a decade ago. So we're not going to be able to help you out in time for your deadline, in effect.
Yeah. Like, I was at that Olympics as well, and of the five Olympics I've been to, it was probably the most enjoyable, Joe.
Right.
And part of it, like, it was very enjoyable from an Irish point of view. There was a fair amount of success, but also you did kind of get caught up in the UK story. Like, there was great atmosphere at the events. They did very well. They ended up third in the medal table. But from what we've learned since, it might well have been the dirtiest Olympics of all. Mm-hmm. Like, if you take the women's 1500-meter final as an example, four of the athletes have since been banned for doping. The athlete with the gold medal now originally came third. So, and that was just repeated across the board in many, many events. And now what's coming out around cycling and UCAD's role does make you wonder, was it just cycling? Because It wasn't that long since the UK had a disastrous result at the Olympics. Like they were really, they really made a huge leap forward in the space of 5 or 6 years. And you'd have to wonder now, when you, the more you hear about it, questions were raised around Mo Farah and the connections he had. You know, is there more stuff going to come out? Is Nick Harris or somebody else going to unearth more stuff? And the excuse that it was nine years ago. It's pathetic, you know, that we can't really answer the question because it's 9 years ago. It is the Olympic Games, you know, it's a major sport, and they had major success, so of course you can investigate.
Yeah. Well, there we are. So we'll see what the fallout is from that over the next couple of days. Fellas, we're out of time. Bernard Jackman, thanks to you. Much appreciated. You. Kieran Cunningham, my thanks to you as well from the Irish Daily Star. And Kieran, you wrote a brilliant piece about the passing of your brother 25 years ago. I know you were talking to Miriam McCallum this morning. I was listening on the way in. A brilliant interview. So people can check your Twitter feed and they'll find a link to the piece. It's well worth checking out. I suspect not easy to write, but I'm sure you're very heartened by the response.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning it. I didn't expect you to mention that. But I just wanted to do something for Daffodil Day other than just say, can people please support? Because with street collections no longer allowed, it's very tough for all charities to raise funds. And it was a hard thing to write and it was hard to talk about. But the reaction was very positive and very grateful for people for the way they reacted.
Mm. No, it definitely struck a chord with people for sure. Well, people can check it out on your Twitter feed. Fellas, thanks so much. Spare a thought for me. I have to spend the next hour talking about the Republic of Ireland.
Show resilience.
All right, bye-bye.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.